Guardian Unlimited.
So this is John Mullen talking to Thomas Keneally for the Guardian Book Club about his novel Schindler's Ark. Of course, Tom doesn't need much introduction to you, but it might be worth saying just a couple of things, because we're here to talk about Schindler's Ark, but Tom has written some 30 other novels, including his most recent one, The Widow and Her Hero, which is published this year, and also lots of other things. You heard Claire mentioning a play. He's written several plays, a good deal of non-fiction, some of it about Australia, some of it not, and at least one screenplay, I think. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
He has an extraordinary CV. He is a former rugby coach. He began life as a trainee priest. He's reached the apogee of his career as a writer. I'm sure you won't mind me saying that through English eyes. Anyway, not by coming to the Guardian Book Club, but by being featured on Desert Island Discs in a week or two. So he must be basking in a glow of career contentment, I hope. Anyway, it's fantastic that he's here, especially to talk about Schindler's Ark, which I remember when it came out in 1982, was a book that lots of people talked about, and I talked about with people. And it's great to have the author. Although, I suppose to me it seems that you wrote in your column in The Guardian about it last Saturday, Tom, that when it came out, it was quite a controversial novel. And I suppose that seems a bit sort of surprising to me now, reading it, perhaps because recovering history through fiction maybe is a bit more common than it used to be, or you might have started other novelists doing it. But I just wanted to ask you, first of all, I know you wrote a little bit about him in The Guardian last week, but we've done quite a few novels in the Guardian Book Club that have dedications. I've never asked about the dedication of one of them before, but I sort of thought I should start with that, because it's dedicated to somebody, correct me if I pronounce it wrong, called Leopold Pfefferberg.
Yes,
I've got it right.
Right. Yes.
And I just wondered if you could just tell us a bit about him, because he comes up in the novel, of course.
Yes, and I've just finished in Australia at home in Sydney, a memoir of the whole process of the book and the film, and Leopold figured heavily in both. His nickname was Poldek, and he was a man from whom, in October 1980, on the way home to Australia, I bought a briefcase. I gave him an Australian MasterCard, and because of our then repute for credit card fraud, the charges were not rung through. I mean, it took about 40 minutes. By then, we were deep in conversation, and he introduced me to the figure of Schindler. He had at the back of his store in the repair room, a filing cabinet full of Schindleriana, which he'd put together himself. And his wife was in the repair room. And I think the story made an impression on me, but he made an impression on me because he was such a strong, vivid, impressive character. And I was faced, in a way, in a concrete way, instead of in a theoretical way, with the proposition, what was it about this man that made my betters amongst the northern Europeans, not yobbos from the colonies like me, but my betters, decide that he was such a threat to European civilization that he had to have his oxygen taken away? So I was impressed both with the story and with this man. And it couldn't have been written without him, because when I went round interviewing people, he served as my introducer. So he virtually said, you can talk to this man. In many cases, he shamelessly said, you can talk to this man because Uncle Poldek wants you to. He did have elements of forceful elements to him, and he did say things that someone who hadn't been through their experience with them could not possibly have said to them. I remember an example. One night in New York, he said, called up a couple on Long Island, and he said, "Thomas and I are in town. One more night, we have just time to interview you." And both the husband and wife were Schindler survivors. And the people who were in midlife and successful Long Islanders said, "Well, Poldek, we've got a dinner engagement. So Schindler saves your life and you don't care." And so he was... I could never have said that to them. You know. So that's why the book is sincerely dedicated to him. Poldek died in 2000. I've written a little memoir of our association, and I hope that dear old Scepter might publish it. If they don't, I'll just leave them, you know.
So did he... I mean, the survivors whom you met and you talked to, was he... Did he actually find some of them for you? How else did you find people?
He had all the addresses.
Right.
There were certain centres of knowledge and certain research bases throughout the world about Oscar. One was the archive that Poldek had been paid by MGM, who in the early 1960s wanted to make a film on Schindler's life, and Schindler was still alive. They commissioned Poldek to put this together, and he got wonderful material. Then he included the flimsies, you know, the flimsy copies of SS telegrams, included copies of the famous list, testimonies, photographs of Oscar and Armin Gert and all the principals in the book. And then there was the man named Mirtek Pampa, who barely appears in the film, who was both Armin Gert's secretary and then Schindler's. And he kept an extra copy of everything that went through Armin Gert's office. So that was an invaluable archive. He saw himself as an ultimate testifier and he would have been shot if they discovered that he was storing extra copies. So he lived in Munich. He was an accountant now, and he also had an archive. And in Israel, a very interesting archive belonging to a man who doesn't figure a lot in the film, Moshe Beisky, who was an Israeli Supreme Court judge, but as an 18-year-old prisoner, used to make these stamps, forge these stamps, which enabled Oscar to make shipments of booze from Moravia and Czechoslovakia into southern Poland. And so on top of that, there was a complete Schindler archives and series of testimonials, not all of them flattering, as I say in the book, in Yad Vashem. So altogether, and Poldek was my leader to all of these sources, and I had access to all these sources because of Poldek.
Yeah, one of the most incredible... I mean, what I hadn't realised when I first read the book years ago was that he's the guy, and I suppose it is partly because of the film that it struck me more. I read the book first before the film, but I've seen the film since I came to the book again, that I didn't realise, reading it the first time, that he was the guy with the suitcases in the ghetto, who does that bizarre thing when they're kind of clearing the ghetto.
That's
and
right.
Killing everybody,
yes.
Of saying,
yes.
Saying to this monstrous man, I've been told to clear
Sir,
the suitcases.
I've been told, yeah.
You know, instead of killing him, they just sort of laugh and go on, or they let him go. They tell him to go.
In the ghetto, when they obliterated the ghetto, and either rounded everyone up or killed everyone, Poldek had this plan to go out via the sewers. And he decided that he'd and take his young wife, Mila, who was a former medical student, and he thought he'd reconnoitre the sewers first. So he went down, he saw that the German machine gunners were at the exits of the sewers and were mowing everyone down. He was on his way back to fetch his wife from their apartment when he heard the bloodhounds and the boots coming, and he hid behind a particular... that I could take you to this day because it's so marked on my memory, in Podgorze, a particular timber yard that's still there, hid behind the door, and then thought, I'm going to be killed here, they got bloodhounds. So he came out and he said, excuse me, Herr Commander, I have been asked to pack up all this luggage. And he started packing suitcases. And that's how he survived. And if you knew him, you would know that, because I saw the way he did similar things when we went to Poland, when it was under martial law and when Solidarity had been outlawed. He behaved in a similar way. I mean, he was such a wonderful operator, in the way that Schindler was, a great operator. And he often said to me, as he went out to change money illegally in the laneway, while I said, but I've got to fill all this out, Poldek. I've got to show that I exchanged my American dollars at the government gambiers. You know, we'll be shot when we leave Poland. We'll be zloty millionaires. And he said, don't talk. You wouldn't have lasted 2 weeks with another. And I know, and I said, well, you're getting on, Poldek. You want me to come with you for protection? No, you'll only screw it up. Leave it there. And he remained like that throughout his life. And he gave Spielberg many a talking to on set. In fact, in the movie, the kid who plays, the actor who plays him, the difference between he and his far more vulnerable wife was that she went to Spielberg and said, thank you, Stephen, for making such a beautiful actress play my part. And Poldek went to the actor and said, Jonathan, you're a good-looking guy, but you're not nowhere near as good-looking as I was. So that was the contrast.
With all that sort of access to all this extraordinary stories and people, I mean, I'm sure you've been asked this question lots of times, but not by me. So I don't know what your answer is. I mean, why you've written lots of nonfiction, and including historical nonfiction, and you wrote that book about the great shame about the political prisoners from Ireland being shipped over to Australia. So you've dealt with sort of extraordinary historical episodes in nonfiction. Were you not tempted to do that with this?
Well, I have, in an inchoate way, thought about this issue. And the issue is this, that the novel is generally about obscure people, even the sort of documentary novel, non-fiction novel, if you want to call it that, a narrative that has all the pretensions of fiction. And I thought Oscar was an obscure enough figure to make a sort of work of faction, like Truman Capote's. When I first heard of it, I thought, the best way to do this is to do it the way Truman Capote did in Cold Blood, or the way that Tom Wolfe did The Right Stuff. And the reason was, the novel is suited not to the king, but to the king's second pillow pusher, who observes everything from a marginal perspective. If you're writing about the king, you probably make it into non-fiction. And I thought Oscar's story was small enough, or obscure enough, or marginal enough to be made into a quasi novel for this reason, that it's intimate. It doesn't say 6 million people died in the Holocaust, end of story. It looks at a man making his way with the sincere desire to be wealthy through every aspect of the Holocaust. He gets an apartment that belonged to Jews. He always claimed to the end of his life that he never took a Jewish business, that he bought a business that was bankrupt, but he bought part of it was with Jewish money, was with people who had nowhere to spend their money, was with wealthy Jews who suddenly were in the ghetto and who wanted to make an investment that reasonably enough helped secure their future. So then he's involved in labor camps because he ran to. He dealt with the horrifying Armengert from the big super camp south of Krakow named Płaszów. And then he was aware of the destruction camps because he got 300 women out of there. But he insisted that he would save people from the destruction camp. And it is notable, and probably didn't come out in the film, that of all the great German industrial companies, like the chemical company IG Farben, or the Krupps, or even Mercedes, no one died of unnatural causes in his factories. In Krupps, 25,000 young Jews who should have survived the war, who had been selected as fit to work, they died. Oscar's achievement is considerable, and one of the limitations of film is that, you know, Oscar wrote this great document. He'd left his wife in Argentina, scandalously. He abandoned her. And he spoke to various Jews in New York and asked them if they could get him an advance to start a business in Europe. And they got him an advance from the joint organization called The Joint. And to get that advance, he had to set out what he spent on positively feeding and saving people, not just what he failed to do. He failed to let the SS into the camp so people were safer. Not just those preventive measures, but the positive measures of feeding and medicine and so on. And it's an impressive document. It was accepted by The Joint. They gave him $50,000. He sank it into a cement factory in Frankfurt, which failed, because he didn't have a black market component and he didn't have sensible Jewish accountants to run it for him. And so that document is a testimony to his positive efforts to produce that result, that no one would die of unnatural causes.
Well, one of the things about him in the novel, which must have been, which I think is the sort of, it seems impertinent in a way to appraise it as a technical achievement of the novel, but I think it is that there remains a certain kind of mystery some of the time about his motivation. It almost feels quite a lot of the time as though, as a novelist who can sort of do anything, there must have been a kind of exercise of restraint on your part in letting almost yourself, not as well as us, not know at certain stages quite why he's... Because he starts off the novel as this, he's an opportunist, isn't he?
Yes, absolutely.
And he almost drifts into... I was writing about it in the newspaper that he starts a novel, he's just trying to do well, and he ends up trying to do good, and he sort of... He sort of drifts into that.
But along the way, he never wanted to be poor.
Yes.
And he certainly never wanted to be shot. He would have been astounded if they'd shot him. And so if the war had lasted another 6 months, it might have come all unstuck. As the book says, you probably read in the book, that his prisoners were nervous that the camp would be closed down because it was running on the black market, and he was... It seemed to him that he had an air... seemed to them that he had an air of irresponsibility to his behaviour, to the brio with which he was taking in extra people, and the brio with which he was pursuing the black market. And sadly, Stephen didn't have enough time to put the black marketeering, the later black marketeering stories in.
Yeah, I mean, you actually say, I mean, the stories that accumulate around him, quite often you say in the narrator, there's a story that he did this, and there's
a
story
I give three versions at one stage. Yeah. And indeed, I noticed that when you speak, this question of where his altruism began and then ended and gave way to opportunism, it was because I couldn't define that I liked him. I'm sorry. And every, you know, if you're amongst a group of survivors, Schindler told me once that he'd done it because, generally after the war, these were post-war pronouncements, he'd done it because of A. Someone else would say, no, he told me he did it because of B. No, that's ridiculous, he did it because of C, D, and E. And so they don't know. And Oscar was asked himself in a German television program why he did it, and he probably gave the best answer. He said, you know, they had human faces. I couldn't let them go when they... You know, no one liked the Jews, but they had human faces. And that's a pretty good answer for a non-self-reflecting man like Oscar.
Now, that's one thing, having seen the film, that when one rereads the novel, that the novel can do, that the film... I think films can sometimes do this, but the film can't do, which is to sort of say, maybe this...
Yes, that's right.
Or maybe that, or a few people say this...
Yeah.
You know, that Schindler's List, the film, shows us, and that's it, and that's what we get, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And indeed, a lot of... recently, an American academic called Dr. Crow, forget his first name, brought out a biography of Schindler, and the press said, oh, there were more than one Schindler's List. Well, that's what the book says.
Yes.
But
yes.
For the simplicity of narrative, Stephen put in one... There were more than one Schindler's List, as the book says, merely because it got messed around with at Plaszow. And the original list, people were able to buy their way onto the second list, so someone was crossed off. And those people were sent to Mauthausen and Auschwitz, the ones who were crossed off. It was beyond Oscar's capacity to prevent that. He didn't even know it was happening. But some of those people who survived the war were bitter that they served him so well in the enamel factory in Krakow and then were crossed off. But they weren't crossed off by him. They were crossed off by a very corrupt Jewish clerk or a Jewish policeman called Marcel Goldberg, who is still execrated by the surviving Schindler survivors.
And what about, this extraordinary... Where did you, as it were, go for your picture of the kind of relationship between Gert and Oscar? Because you say somewhere quite explicitly at one stage in the novel, the reflection can hardly be avoided that Amon was Oscar's dark brother, the berserk and fanatic executioner Oscar might, by some unhappy reversal of his appetites, have become. I mean, there's a weird sort of bond between them almost.
Yes, Oscar had no problem drinking with Gert and doing business with Gert. And down in the basement was poor old Helen Hirsch, whom I met in Tel Aviv in 1981, and she had a little jewelry store, and she tells me quite frankly that Oscar would come down and see her and say, how are things going, bring her some chocolate and so on, and then go up and drink more brandy with Armin Gert. And she told me the story about him playing cards for her. Mm. Now, if he did that, that's a very callous thing to do. That's a double-edged thing to do, to play cards for a slave, which she was. But that's what Oscar was like. Oscar was a sort of... He was who he was, you know, and the survivors all say that. And interestingly, after the war, he started going to Israel and they'd look after him, but they're all successful bourgeois people. So he hated it. They'd say, one of them, Moshe Beisky, said to him, "You can have only three brandies in my house, Oscar. You know, I love you, but you can have only three brandies." And that was like saying, you know, saying, "You can have lemonade with dinner," to Oscar. It was not even the start of a good drink. And so he'd go back to Frankfurt for the low life. Very interesting figure. There is actually a figure like him in my new book, and I'm not trying to sell that, but there is a sort of, you know how Lawrence of Arabia was a kind of literally a bastard misfit before World War I, and then he has his season of glory, of effulgence, and then he doesn't know what to do for the rest of his life. And Oscar was that sort of fellow.
In the novel, and perhaps this is another advantage of writing it as a novel, however historically truthful, rather than as a work of non-fiction. In the novel, it struck me that, in a way, the obscurity of his motives was kind of what made him so successful, because the Germans themselves seem to have not...
That story you tell,
which I presume is true, of Gert wanting him to appear as a character witness for him at his trial after the war,
that
they couldn't see through
him.
That sort of... that he seemed so much the kind of opportunist that they were happy to go along with his schemes.
And wonderful things happen in research. And I went to a doctor who knew him in Sydney, Dr. Rosley, Roman Rosley, who had been in Plaszow, a young medical officer in Plaszow camp. And he had the complete Polish transcript of Gert's trial, and he translated it for me. He was very anxious to do it, and it had pictures which Steven Spielberg used in the film. He was hanged from a butter box, a low box, Armin Gert, and it's extraordinary the serendipitousness of research. But let me say, there's a friend of mine here today, Jonathan Blair. Jonathan started making a documentary almost as soon as the book came out on Oscar, and Jonathan found Gert's old girlfriend in Vienna, which Poldek and I didn't. And she was dying of emphysema, and she sends a chill through you in your documentary, Jonathan, which has been shown over and over and over again by now. You could maybe manage alone, Jonathan. But anyhow, so much for the serendipitous...
What, she sends a chill because...
Yes, she was dying of emphysema, and Jonathan asked her, "Was Oscar a good Nazi?" And she says, barely having the breath for it, she says, "We were all good Nazis. We were all good Nazis." So there you go. I mean, Oscar was certainly another story Jonathan came across, which Crow then researched for his biography. The war started, you might remember, the few old people in the audience who were alive at that time. The war started with a faked attack on a German language radio station in Poland, but on the German border. And it was a Volksdeutsch, a Polish-German radio station. And German troops entered, disguised as Polish troops, entered and shot up the Volksdeutsch radio announcers and technicians. And this was used as the reason Hitler had to invade Poland to protect the Volksdeutsch in Silesia and other places. And to do this, they needed to get uniforms from the Polish army. Now, Oskar was an operative of German military intelligence, amongst all else, so, as you know from the book. And according to what Jonathan found out, or Jonathan encountered a story, that Oskar was the agent who found those German those Polish uniforms. And it seems all too true to me that Oskar would bowl up to some Polish depot before the war with booze and luxury ham and so on, and bulldust some and pay some Polish ordnance officer to supply whatever was needed. It's all too true that Oskar would do that. I don't know if it's been documentarily, but I'm sorry I didn't know that to throw into the book, of course, that Oskar actually started World War II.
Okay, I just want to ask you one more question about the book, about him, before I throw it open, because talking about him and his motives, there is a kind of a very memorable episode in the book, which was sort of caught to some extent in the film, and people might remember it from that, but I think it's much more memorable in the book, where he's riding with his horse, Oskar is,
yes,
and with one of his girlfriends in the park on the hill above the ghetto, and he sees the ghetto being cleared, and he sees something. It is like, it's not just that he sees these terrible things happening, but he seems at that moment in your narrative to kind of suddenly sort of realise something about the future, because he sees these kind of casual murders taking place in front of this little girl, whom they're not killing. They're sort of pushing and gently ushering her on to join a sort of a line of people, but they're making no attempt to disguise what they're doing for her and from her. And he thinks, you know, if he thinks two things, as I remember, he thinks, first of all, if there's no shame, then this is all official. This isn't just random. This is all organized and ordered. But also, he thinks they're not worrying about witnesses, so they're not planning to leave any witnesses. And it's a kind of éclaircissement for him, isn't it? I mean, is that, as it were, how do you know that sort of happened, or what is it? Did he talk about that?
He talks about that himself, but Crow says that you can't see the ghetto from the top of this hill. But I've been up there with Poldek on top of Bedniskiego, and you can see the streets running in the direction of the river. You can't see these streets, but you can see the other streets, and they were all being cleared out. And he claims that he knew that, sorry, I'm not certain of the documentation at this distance of time, but he described the scene to at least one man. Mm. And that man was a man called Samuel Springman, who worked for the Jewish Rescue Organization in Hungary. Actually from Istanbul. Springman was a man I interviewed for the book. He was still alive, though very elderly. And he was given all this money by the joint to run a rescue organization out of Istanbul. And he was operating in Hungary, because you might remember Hungary wasn't occupied by the Germans till 1844. And Oskar, 1944, rather. Yeah, I know I'm old, but 1944. So the Poldek came out on a train full of newspapers to have a meeting with Springman, and the incident is related in the book. It's not in the film. And he describes the ghetto clearance to Springman, which he saw from horseback, and he describes the people who were sent out. Actually, it was a earlier clearance he saw from his horse. About 6,000 or 7,000, 8,000 people gathered up and sent to Belzec's. Well, at Belzec's, we have a first-hand account of what happened to them with the, not with Cyclone B, with carbon monoxide. And the first-hand account comes from an SS man called Kurt Gerstein. But Oscar knew what had happened to them, so he told Springman in the winter of 42-43 that they were exterminating people. And Springman couldn't believe it. Springman was astonished himself. As a former German, he couldn't believe it himself, that this country would use methods like that to expunge a minority. And, of course, so that's how Springman is our evidence for Schindler's observance of that first big clearance of the ghetto, and then for the fact that they were had opened Majdanek, Treblinka, Sobibor, and so on. And it was only later that they, a Cyclone B party came along and said, we've got to use... well, I describe all that in the book anyhow.
Please, I've asked enough questions. I've got more, but I've asked enough, I'm sure. Is there anybody here, gentleman at the back, who'd like to ask Tom? If you just pause a second, sir, while...
I'd speak as someone who, under different circumstances, might have been a victim, or certainly my parents, and I'd like to thank you for humanising the Holocaust, an episode of the Holocaust story. Because it shows that the deniers just don't know what they're talking about. But I've got two questions for you. Did Spielberg's movie do your book justice, in your opinion? Are you allowed to tell us? And secondly, why was Ark changed into a list?
All I felt about the film was that from the beginning, Spielberg, and he took over 10 years to make it, but he was interested in the ambiguity of Oscar. And so I felt that insofar, you know, inside every writer is a certain hubris that says no film could be up to the strength of this novel. You know, it's one of the compensations for our poverty. But I felt that it was in good hands. I felt he made a mistake or two towards the end, particularly in the scene that everyone cries about, where he says, I could have done more, I could have sold my badge. In reality, he's, if it was only occurring to him then it makes him seem a bit dumb. But in reality, the camp was already bulging at the sides. You know, he had people in there who were not supposed to be in there. And so it was... to an extent, indeliberately unfair to him. But insofar as it captured his opportunism, the strange blend of altruism and desire for wealth, I thought it was very successful. When in 1992, Spielberg told me that he was going to make it in black and white, I was too polite to say, that's a crazy idea, Stephen. But apparently everyone was telling him it was a crazy idea. I can't imagine the film without it, without that black and white, what would you call it, that black and white style. And so I was pretty pleased with, given that, you know, it's like for a price... You know, in the societies of the past, our great-great-grannies were sold to a groom and the groom got some cattle and so on. And it still happens in parts of the world. So I got my cattle, which I quickly spent, sadly, on other follies like The Great Shame, paying for the research for The Great Shame. But... I got the cattle, but you do wonder whether the daughter will be happy with the groom. And he treated the property, as they call it, the springboard for his own authorship with respect. So I was very happy. And I've got to say, he was very kind and courteous to me all along. Then your second question, sir.
The title,
yeah. Now, when we took it to America to sell it, there was a crazy man in charge of Simon & Schuster who'd made his reputation by publishing the early Arnold Schwarzenegger bodybuilding books. And he said, if you call it Schindler's Ark, all American jewry will be offended because you're implying they entered like passive creatures. And I said, no, the Ark of the Covenant. Remember, there's a sort of rough compact between a covenant between Oscar and his people. And he said, no, they won't get that. No one, he meant, I don't get that. They won't get that. And so ultimately, after 3 months of argument, we consented to Schindler's List. And that question has haunted us ever since. But when I say we, I'm not talking like the monarch. I'm talking me and my agent consented. When it came time to make the film, I asked Spielberg, would he change the name back to Ark? And at last there'd be revenge for that silly 3 months of argument. And he said he had a better reason. He said he wanted to use lists as a visual tool throughout the film. And he did. So his argument was better than the bodybuilding bookman.
Okay. Yes, one of the problems with your type of book is that I misdescribe usually as faction, a mixture of fact and fiction, right?
Yeah.
And what I want to ask really is, are there any major items in the book that are purely fiction and not based on anything in reality?
No, that is an interesting question. I only use dialogue which people gave to me. If a Jewish prisoner said, I went to Spielberg and I said, wrong rescuer, Schindler, and said to him, and Schindler said to me, if a few of them said roughly the same dialogue, I'd use it. The account of dialogue early in the book, where he's talking about with SS men and others about the Jews and about how they'll be running up stars in no time and selling Stars of David, that is based on a document. That's based on one of the testimonies of a survivor in which he recounts conversations. So it's not exactly, it's good enough for faction. It wouldn't be good enough if you were G.M. Trevelyan, you know.
Perhaps I didn't make that point clear enough. It wasn't so much the conversation, but the events.
Now, what happened was that everyone I interviewed was worried about two facts. That if I got things badly wrong, it would rebound in terms of denial. They're also anxious about their fellow survivors of the Holocaust who had never met anyone like Oscar. And they said they had a common experience of telling people about Oscar and their own people saying, that's all, you know, keep quiet about this, he's a Nazi, etc. So when the book was finished, it was read by at least 10 former prisoners and others, cover to cover. It was read by Moshe Beisky, by Mrs. Stern, by Mirtek Pemper, by Poldek Pfefferberg, and a number of other people. And then individuals like the Feigenbaum family, who are still flourishing in America, they've changed their name to Fagans, they just wanted to see the chapter about them. And to make sure I didn't misquote them, you know. Similarly, the Dresdners in Tel Aviv. Similarly, a couple called the Corns in Sydney, who were dear people, great people. They actually discovered equality in Australia, but not the sort of, maybe not the best form of equality, but it was superior to what they had under the Nazis. Edek Korn said to me, Mila came home from work when we first arrived here, and she said, it's wonderful. They hate the Polish Catholics as much as they hate us. Equality at last. And so it was heavily corrected by, not only by Poldek, but by fellows who were sticklers for the truth, like Pempa and Moshe Beisky. And so that was very useful. Now, I've never written a so-called novel where you send the book for correction by the characters. But it was a wonderful experience. I didn't want it any other way.
The lady here.
I actually happen to be the daughter of survivors of the Holocaust, and it's always fascinated me why people helped or why people didn't help. If you had met Schindler in a pub or anywhere, would you have picked him as somebody who was a likely saviour of other people?
This is a fascinating question because he is unlikely. He is a yobbo from the German Reich equivalent of Queensland, the sedate one. You know, Queenslanders, we call them banana benders because we reckon they grow the bananas straight and then spend their lives bending. Anyhow, no, enough ethnic hatred. I must correct that. But, back to the question again. Your simple question. You'd expect him to be prime material for the, not only for the traditional European anti-Semitism, which had been in place for 2,000 years and which was a stain on Christendom. I firmly believe that it was the arse end of Christendom, anti-Semitism. And it was so profoundly placed in Central Europe and Eastern Europe. And you'd think he'd make a good SS man. And, I mean, he was interested in labour supply, so what did it matter if people died on his factory floor? They were only parasites. They were lice. They were fumigatable material. So he's the last person you'd pick. And then, of course, he was vulgar, materialistic. He hadn't been schooled in the universal brotherhood of... But I look... One survivor said to me, if you want to know the sort of fellow Oscar was, look at a book about another great opportunist and chancer called The Good Soldier Zweig. Have you ever read... And Zweig came from the Sudetenland. And this fellow said the Sudetenlanders always were less ready to take orders. They were, you know, freer spirits than maybe someone from Bavaria might be.
Tom, by the way, two things. The first is that it was Emily, Schindler's wife, and also his mistress, who swore absolutely blind to me that he was responsible for the Polish uniforms that started World War II.
Yes,
Oscar did indeed start World War II. If he hadn't been there, though, you don't have to be a Marxist to know that someone else would have. Motive is clearly something that we are all obsessed with in this story. And I'm always think that all the Schindler Jews, the Schindler survivors, always said to me, who cares, he saved us. But it's our privilege as literary critics, novelists, historians, filmmakers, to think about motive. And I actually suspect that both you and I got it wrong. I remember that Kurt Ludke called me, the first scriptwriter that Spielberg employed. He'd just died.
No, he
the
was
second, maybe he was the second or third.
Yeah.
But
I only know that because I was the first.
That's right. You had been dropped. Ludke, who had just done up.
I'd been sacked in the best way possible. Yeah, and Ludke got onto it.
And
yeah.
He'd just done Out of Africa, and he called me. I was living in upstate New York, and he said, "What do you think Oscar's motives were?" Ludke at that stage had written 15 pages of screenplay, and he'd been on the job for 3 months, and he was rather baffled. And I suppose we talked for 3 or 4 hours, and at the end of it, we kind of, both of us felt we didn't really know. I actually think that in a curious way, Stephen Zalian, the final screenwriter, the one whose film got made, got it really right. Because what he did in the character of Itzhak Stern, the Ben Kingsley character, if you like, was amalgamated three characters. He took Stern on the one hand, Bankier, the Jewish businessman who actually originally owned the enamel factory in Krakow, and Mitek Pampa, the character you refer to, Amon Goetz's secretary. And he turned them into one character. And my own view is that I missed completely in my film for all of its awards and all the rest, and what I don't think was as clear in your book for all of its awards, was that Oscar was played like a violin by Stern,
these three blokes,
and Pemper.
Yeah.
And that they knew who they were dealing with. They knew a man whose vanity was everything. They knew a man who, for whom wealth and material things were everything. They knew a man who, in order to sustain this, had to have a successful business. And the difference between Oscar post-war, as you rightly say, is that he didn't have a smart Jew running his business for him.
Yeah.
He was the classic head of marketing in modern terminology,
yes.
Oscar. And Stern, Banker, and Mitek Pemper were the three characters who played this character for the benefit of the Jews. They weren't doing it for themselves, they were doing it for their fellow
Jews. Yeah.
And the other thing which is key in this, and which again I think both you and I missed, was that Oscar lost the majority of his original Jews. That shipment which you talk about in your novel, where he's striding along the platform organizing the feeding of the Jews that are about to be shipped off, the thing that isn't clear in your book, and I only found out much later, is that all of the people on that train were his ex-Jews. And the reason why there were so many spaces, more than 300 spaces on the list, which finally makes it to the Sudeten, is because there are 300 less workers who have been shipped off. So it's not so much, although there was the whole thing about the corrupt Jew running the list and people being crossed
mm-hmm.
off, but actually 300 people never made it. Oscar couldn't save them.
Well, I mean, you're quite right. I would plead it's a matter of emphasis. When Bankier was rounded up by accident, he didn't have his papers with him, his Ken Carter or something, and was being sent to off in a train, Oscar came and retrieved him. In the movie, it's Stern. And what he said to Bankier was, when he was taking him away, you got to be more careful. If you were sent to the East, how would I run my business, you know? To hell with you, you've got to... And those three gentlemen were the basis of his business, no question. And it was because post-war he didn't have them that he was such a catastrophe to himself.
Well, I think it's time for Tom to sign some books, if you would, if anybody would... like Tom
yes,
to sign a
sure.
book, and just to thank him very much for talking so absorbingly about these terrible things, and yet also oddly sort of being so humorous as well.
Thanks
very much, Tom.
Guardian Unlimited.